Liu Peng is the director of the Puxi Institute for Social Sciences in Beijing. He is also a senior research fellow of the Institute of American Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, which is the premier social science research institute in the People's Republic of China. He is also a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University. He is the author of many books and articles, including two important books, State, Religion, and Law, published in 2006, and Contemporary American Religions, published in 2001. He's also an innovator in China. He has started the first website on law and religion in China. On a personal note, I have attended several conferences in China and also in Vietnam that have been organized through the efforts of Liu Peng, and I can tell you that he is a leading voice, academic voice in China regarding law and religion matters, and in particular for freedom of religion. Professor Peng.
First, I want to thank all of you and my host, the Center of the International Center of the Law and Religion in Brigham Young University, invite me to be here. I'm so honored to share something about religion and law in China. Okay. First, I give you some very rough idea about religion's situation in China. Maybe some of you already know the religion situation. Some are not. So here are just the quick facts to show what happened in China on religion. According to government, our official's announcement, we have almost 100 million religion believers. But according to academic scholars' research recently, probably over 300 million believers. That's a big difference. For the religion, we have five recognized religions, which is Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, Protestant, and the Roman Catholic. Okay, someone may say, may ask, why is only five? It's just a very simple reason, because in 1949, when Communist Party took over power, it was five religions, so they recognize five religions until today. For the rest of religion, it's just so complicated. We can talk later. For all the religions, government has some numbers, give you an idea. This is just a number announced by government or recognized by government. Who are a religion believer? This is a very different understanding. Before, people say, oh, it's just an old lady in a rural area, no education. But recently, if you go to China, you meet people who are religion believer, no matter in the Buddhism or Protestant. It's just a very different situation you can tell. Very high education, holds a degree. Someone white collar working in urban. The bottom line of the religion situation is we haven't opened the free market for religion yet. So no free market for religion. And the demand and the supply is not balanced. This is from an economical point of view. But from political view, that's more complicated, which is in what kind of degree government want to share power with people, which related to NGO, how much government want to open the society for civil society. Okay, for each religion, we have a different issues or problem, or we have a each own characteristic. For the Taoism, this is a native religion in China, probably the weakest religion in China. The influence is very small. Buddhism, that's most influential or popular religion in China. Hard to say how many, but this is a religion considered as one of the Chinese culture or tradition. We have three major denominations or schools for the Buddhism. One is Han Buddhism, mainly in inner China. Then Tibetan Buddhism, mainly in Tibet and inner Mongolia. And some Buddhism in Yunnan, which is Sri Lanka or Burma. This shows the three schools. For Islam, this is a big problem currently. They are all in the northwest on the border, mainly in Xinjiang, for 10 minority groups, 14 million. Roman Catholics. This is another issue. I don't know whether the 5 million is accurate, but at least 5 million. It's not as very big as Protestant, but this is some numbers the government recognized. For Protestant, this is a real problem. The problem is, it's just because complicated situation among Protestant itself. Recognized or registered official church and unregistered church, we call the house church. Government side, we have 18 million or maybe 20 million. But someone, according to academic research or scholars, they think probably 50 or 60 million. Some China ministry work, they may say 100 million. So I will say in the middle, 50 or 60 million probably is pretty true or conservative estimates. The issue for the Protestant our Christian church is house church is a problem for several decades. It's not just recently, but start from 1949 till today. Never served. The house church is everywhere. It's just a phenomenon. You cannot ignore it. Where are the house churches located? Mostly in inner China, Henan or Shandong, but also in a big city like Beijing or Shanghai. This shows the pictures. For the Roman Catholics, there's a similar issue. China cut down the relation with the Pope in 1957-58. Since then, the government appointed the bishop. So there is an issue, who should have a right to appoint the bishop? So China negotiated with Roma for the normalization, but never reached the point because of this right. So the Catholic has an underground church who loyalty to Roma. Then government has a patriarchal church which organized by government. So this picture shows Tibetan Buddhism. This picture I took in Lhasa 2 months ago when I was in Lhasa and Rikaza. You can see people worship in the biggest temple, Da Zhao Si. After the people, you see the armed policemen. Each 3 minutes, they just go around, never stop with a gun. There is a tension there. And this is a new Panchen Lama, recognized by government, maybe not by the Dalai Lama. Islam. recently caused a big problem in Xinjiang. You all know that by report. The problem for the Buddhism is not real political problem, but it's another kind of issue, which is a lot of unimproved or improved temples built everywhere. They just built the temple according to themselves without government's permit. So overall, for the religion, there is a very fundamental issue, which is are they legal or illegal? So legal status is always an issue for every religion. Besides that, as I said, the underground church for Catholic, house church for Protestant, we have other issues for the other religions. Look this. You all know that we were there yesterday in the temple of Salt Lake City. So Mormon, is Mormon a religion or not? Orthodox. Can Orthodox have a church in China? This man is from Israel. He wants to find the roots or something about Jewish in Shanghai. Can they recognized by government as a religion? Besides this religion, we have something else we call the folk belief. It's no name for them, or they have a name, like a Mazu. It's hard to say they are religion or not, but they are just the people. Very big number. Every year, they have lots of activities. What you call them? No name, no recognition. So that's very complicated. So who is controlling religion? Garmed set up all the administration office from top to lowest level, called RAB, Religion Affairs Bureau. They changed the name recent years, called SARA, State Administration of Religion Affairs. This is their office in Beijing, the highest one. Since 1991 till today, government use a regulation, which is not a law, but functioned like a law, plus administrative office to control religion. There is an issue among all the religions, which is do government treat all the religion, we talk the recognized religion, equal or not? Regardless of the unrecognized religion, they are illegal, so we don't need to talk them. Even for the recognized religion, still different. For Buddhism, government spent huge money recently try to support them, grow them, favor them, as well as Taoism and Confucianism. The purpose is try to small other religions space, make a we call it the foreign religion weak. Otherwise, government field, oh, if we trade religion same, the Christianity or maybe Protestant growing too fast, but Buddhism we support should grow up, but may not be big enough. So they make a different policy towards a different religion instead of treat all the religion bad like before. So it's a little different or a big different. The reason we do that is because some concern in Communist Party's heart, which is if someone as a believer of Protestant or Roman Catholics, are they loyal to their religion or the Communist Party or China? It's always an issue. So most of religion group, they have some kind of issue, but for the minority, they are all the religion believers. So when you talk the religion, it's part of the issue is a minority issue. In the year 2004, China established or passed the first regulation on religion, which is not law. This is a big problem. It's a legal problem, violates the constitution, because we don't have a law on religion. Then government make a administrative regulation functioned like law without approved by legislation by Congress. This is our constitution. According to Constitution Article Number 36, Chinese citizens enjoy the freedom of religion, but there is no law actually can implement, can protect the rights of religious freedom. That's why all the local government can move freely. Lots of conflicts, tension between government and the religion believer. It's just because the different understanding on the regulation and the constitution. Since that, I started to do things, try to switch power from administration office to rule of law. This is the headquarters of Chinese Academy of Social Science, where I'm working there as a government think tank. We hold a conference to talk religion and the law, try to understand what is the relation between religion and the law, or religion and the state. What is the church-state separation issues, church's autonomy, church's fairness, all these kind of issues. Who should register church, or whether government should be a judge to give a definition, who is a real good religion, who is bad religion, or is religion or not religion. Everyone understands the rule of law is good. Why we need to make a law? Government think if we have a law, we can control religion, we can rule religion, regulating religion. People think if we have a law, we can protect the religion. Different group has a different idea on the rule of law, on religion. This one is just to get a position, promote as a director of Sarah, State Administration of Religion Affairs, Wang Zuan, Mr. Wang Zuan, who was my former colleague 20 years ago. And his boss, Ye Xiaowen, has gone 2 weeks ago. And this person is a chairman of Three Self Church of all Christianity in China. So they make things looks like we have all perfect religion freedom on Christian. But it's very controversial. It depends who you are and where you ask. Because we have this kind of issue, I started to do things, try to change all the situation on religion fees in China. To make a change, probably we need to make change from constitutional level instead of just focus on one case, one meeting place, or one religion. This is a history or track, start from year 2002 till year 2008. Continue to have a conference, symposium to talk religion and law or rule of law. Last year, I host a conference on house church, first time in China's or in Chinese history to openly, publicly talk what is a house church, who is house church, why is house church, and how can we deal with them? Invite the government officials, house church leaders, medias, and intellectuals, let them to talk. What's the problem? And international symposium we hosted in China. On the back, you may see this gentleman very high, called Durham. And some, this is the largest law university in Chongqing, produced 60% lawyers, judges in China. We had a conference there to talk about religion and the rule of law. This one is Oslo, Norway. We moved our conference to Oslo. Each 2 years, we had international symposium on religion and the rule of law. That's just one of them. Last year, we back to China, say Calderon, and our chairman today, where it is, I cannot see you. It must be, can you find yourself? Okay. Oh, here is, okay. This is our host, the co-sponsor, Cole, and that's me. Government. Put this news on the main Voice, People's Daily, Guangming Daily. it means government also paid attention on this kind of efforts because this is an issue. Certain China Morning Post reported this. This is back to year 2002. We had the first religion and the politics symposium. The conclusions, China's religious problem needs a political change. It's not just one single issue. If we don't have a civil society, we have no NGOs, it's very difficult to give privilege for the religious group because we need freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom of belief. Religion freedom requires all these three freedom. If we don't have that three freedom, you cannot only give a religion group this three freedom without the majority of people who are non-believers. So that is a problem beyond the religion issue. Although we had a success on economy or economical reform. So legislation, comprehensive law, or make a law, rule of law on religion is very necessary. But even we have a law, it never means we solved all the problem. If we don't have a law, we have no legal base. Once we have a law, we still need to work like this, jaywalk. We have a traffic control here. It's a light is red. People just ignore that, continue to walk. While the vehicles goes, and someone even walk here. So is this a nation under the rule of law or not? It takes a while for us to get the common understanding. We believe we will have a bright future, but we have to work on that. Thank you.
And in the church-state relationship and religious corporations law. He is a graduate of the Kyoto University, where he studied law. Professor Tajika does not know this, but...
So I must start my speech with excuse. So if my presentation does not interest you, I'd like to ask you to think that is because of my jet lag. I will turn to the theme. The Constitution of Japan of 1946 guarantees freedom of religion and declares the separation of church and state. Japanese jurists have struggled to establish religious freedom through the courts, which have the power of judicial review, and they have succeeded to some extent. It seems to me, however, the role of government to further work of religious freedom has been overlooked in Japan. But I think we cannot deny that political branches also have played a certain role to further religious freedom. In this presentation, I will introduce the present situation in Japan regarding the role of the judiciary and the political branches to further the work of religious freedom. For the translators, I will pass the historical background. Article 20, Section 1 of the Constitution of Japan provides that freedom of religion is guaranteed to all. And this provision is generally understood as guaranteeing freedom of religious conscience, freedom to conduct one's religious worship, and freedom of religious associations. We have no comprehensive non-establishment clause, which is seen in the US Constitution, but our Constitution provides no religious organization shall receive any privileges from the state, nor exercise any political authority. The state and its organs shall refrain from religious education or any other religious activities, and no public money or other property shall be expended or appropriated for the use, benefit, or maintenance of any religious institution or association. Therefore, it is widely accepted that the Japanese Constitution adopts the separation system. As I stated earlier, Japanese jurists have centered their efforts on the furtherance of religious freedom through the courts. Though some jurists criticize the Japanese Supreme Court is too conservative to invalidate legislations or administrative acts. But it seems to me that the criticism is somewhat one-sided, and Japanese courts also have played a certain role to guarantee religious freedom in post-war Japan. Though there are not so many cases in which the infringement of religious freedom was alleged, I can present the Kobe City College of Technology case as one example in which the Supreme Court played the active role. A college student, Jehovah's Witness, refused to take kendo, kendo is Japanese fencing, kendo class, because practicing any martial art is prohibited by his religious belief. As a result of refusal, the student could not earn the credit of required subject of physical education and eventually expelled from the college. So he brought the action for withdrawal of the expulsion, insisting that enforcing him to take kendo class against his religious belief and expelling him for the reason of his refusal infringed his freedom of religion. The Supreme Court found that because his refusal to participate in kendo class is grounded on the core of his sincere religious belief, and because he was driven into the situation of expulsion as a result of his religiously motivated refusal, the expulsion has a nature that led him to act against his own religious belief if he wished to avoid the serious disadvantage. According to the court, the college could offer alternative classes in the proper way and form which does not appear partial to him, and such alternative class would not impair the educational order in the college nor seriously disturb the operation of the college. So the court held that the decision of the college to expel him was unconstitutional. Among the numerous separation cases, I can point out the Ehime Tamagushiryo case as the example in which the Supreme Court plays the active role. This case was related to spending of public money to religious corporations. From 1981 to 1986, the governor of Ehime Prefecture offered 166,000 yen to Yasukuni Shrine and other organizations in the name of the church for sprig of a sacred tree, and the inhabitant brought the action, alleging the government act violated separation of church and state. The Supreme Court found it is hard to think that an ordinary person would evaluate the dedication of the offerings as one of the social courtesy. The court continued, we cannot deny that the prefecture became intentionally entangled with a particular religious organization. If a local public entity becomes entangled with the particular religious organization in the special manner as seen in this case, such an entanglement will give an ordinary person the impression that the prefecture specially supports them because of their superiority to others, and the ordinary person will become interested in them. The court concluded because Ehime Prefecture's spending to Yasukuni Shrine has the purpose of religious significance and the effect to support, promote, or further the particular religion, it is in violation of separation of church and state. There is a good reason why the role to guarantee religious freedom has been expected almost exclusively to the judiciary by Japanese jurists. As you could easily imagine, it seems natural to think that the political branches cannot be expected to play this kind of role because they consist of members selected by majority decision and will be dominated by the religious majority. Moreover, because it is support of Shinto shrines by conservative politicians that that has been attacked in separation cases in post-war Japan. It might be also natural to Japanese jurists to think they cannot trust them. But the political branches have not always been the threat to religious freedom in Japan. Rather, if we closely look at the current Japanese law, we can find many examples which show the accommodation of religion by them. As such an example, I can point out the existence of Religious Cooperation Act. The act was enacted in order to give religious organizations legal ability to own buildings and properties. It is said, at the time of the Allied occupation, the general headquarters of the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers studied abolishing the pre-war act, which had specially regulated religious corporations and treating them as one of public benefit corporations generally regulated by the civil code. GHQ thought that if the special statute which regulates only religious corporations enacted, it showed the government is too interested in religions. But it was the prevalent opinion of the leaders of religious organizations that the civil code contained too many restrictions. Certainly, the public benefit corporations incorporated by the Japanese civil code at that time had the characteristic of the corporation about which the state authorized the public benefit or social utility. The civil code adopted the authorization system with wide administrative discretion as to incorporation of public benefit corporations and vested the administrative organs with the powers to supervise and control the activities. If religious corporation, these religious organizations had to be subject to such an authorization system, their incorporation would have to depend on the preference of administrative organs. If supervision and control by the administrative organs reach religious cooperation, the result, contrary to separation of church and state, would be certain to occur. Therefore, in Japan, the special ordinance which regulated only religious corporations was first issued in order to avoid these consequences, and the current Religious Corporations Act inherited this idea. The current Religious Corporations Act provides that those who wish to found a religious corporation must submit the documents prescribed by the Act and acquire the certification by the Minister of Education or the Governor of Prefecture. This administrative act of certification is understood as an act of confirmation, indicating the administrative organ's judgment that the submitted document meets the requirements by the act, and act as an act without administrative discretion. Today, the discretionary powers of the administrative organs over religious corporations are thus denied. It seems clear that Religious Corporations Act was enacted not because the Diet legislature was too interested in religious affairs, but because the Diet thought that it is necessary to deter the government from intervening into religious organizations. What I can say from the Japan's experience described above is that even if we have the good reason to focus on the role of the judiciary when we are going to further religious freedom, we should pay attention to the political branches too. The political branches can further religious freedom. Of course, we must keep our eyes on them so that they never infringe religious freedom, but at the same time, we can work on them to to take necessary measures to further religious freedom. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Tajika sensei, arigatou gozaimashita. Eigo wa muzukashii desu ne. Minasan yoku wakarimashita. Totemo jozu dekishita. Soshite omoshiro katta. Our third speaker is Professor Kanak Bikram Thapa, the former dean of the Tribhuvan Law School in Nepal, in Kathmandu. He is the chair of the Constitutional Law Subject Committee and the president of several important law reform initiatives in Nepal. Nepal is in the midst of a very difficult and important discussion about its constitutional future. And I can say from personal experience and from the bottom of my heart that Professor Thapa is a very important force for good in that constitutional debate. This past February, several of us from BYU Law School, Professor Durham and myself, attended a conference in Kathmandu about proposals for a new constitution, and we were also invited and hosted graciously at the Tribhuvan Law School, where we made a presentation to faculty and students, and were very impressed with the quality of students and the quality of the law school in Kathmandu. Professor Thapa.
Thank you very much for your kind words to me and my law school, which I worked many years over there. Indeed, it is my great privilege and honor to be here. I am very thankful to Professor Cole Durham, who invited me here to participate in this conference. And the organizer had asked me to make a short presentation about the law and religion in Nepal. So now I'm not going to make a long presentation with the academic analysis and all the everything about it. We have the extent of times and everything. So just I am going to present you the part the Nepalese position is in regarding the law and religion in Nepal. And another important thing, as the previous speakers has maintained, that of course Nepal is in the transitional period. We have a long Maoist in arms insurgency, and we have the just 2-3 years ago the Maoists has come into the peaceful accord, and they agreed to hold the constitutional assembly election and making a new constitutions. So now Nepal is in the political transitions. So it is very important for at this juncture the religious freedom and the position of religion in the Nepalese constitution and the law. So of course now Nepal is in the process of the making new constitutions. So as we know that among the 7 South Asian countries, Nepal is the one of them. Among the South Asian countries, we have from the religious point of view, we have the different experience in whole of the regions. For example, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Maldives are the Islamic country. Sri Lanka and the Bhutan is a Buddhist country. India is a secular country. And till 2007, Nepal was a Hindu kingdom. So you can find all sort of diversity within that small region. So whereas the religion in Nepal is a concern, one should not forget that the overwhelming population of Nepal is the Hindu. In the census of 1981, the Hindu population was around 89%. In the census of 1991, the Hindu population came down to about 86%. And the last census, which was held in 2001, the Hindu population still come down to 80%. The reasons of declining of the Hindu population is various. One reason may be the inflection of the population was not the real one. And the down of the democracy the constitutionally guarantee the right to the freedoms and the religion psychology over and the real picture emerge. That may be the one reason. Another reason may be that some people are very frustrated with the Hindu caste structure, and especially the lower caste people in converted to the another religions. May be the reason, but it should be analyzed. It is just only the superficially I am telling you. But anyway, even in the within this, beside the Hindu, there are another 20%. Within this 20% or so, the maybe the 10 to 11% are the Buddhist religion. And sometimes the Buddhist and Hindu religion are so much intermixed, it is very difficult to distinguish them also. Remaining 9 to 10% which consist of the Christianity, Muslims, non-believers, and the nature worshippers, and so on. So within the estimated 28 million of population of Nepal, so the religion-wise, the population is divided in this ratio. Whereas, just I tell you that I am going to present you the legal and constitutional position of the religion freedom in the country. So legally speaking, Nepal has gone through the 6th constitutions and in the process of making the 7th one. First time, the codified law was promulgated in Nepal in 1854. It is a, you know, that codified law in Nepali we call it the Mulki Ain. If you translate roughly, it comes to the national code. It has a 63 chapters and 1,400 pages. So each chapters, some chapters deals with the criminal law, some with the criminal procedures, civil law, civil procedures, divorce, family affairs, everything that national code deals with each and everything about the law. If you go to, there are the two provisions about the religions in this national code before coming to the constitution, which are declared in the 1854. There are two provisions. One provisions, they guarantees all the Nepalese to practice their religions and faiths, which is they had, you know, they had transformed from ancient time to generation. It strictly, this is the unique position in Nepal, that it strictly prohibits conversion from one religion to the another religion. No matter whether it is voluntary or forcefully. My learned Indian justice is here. In India also there are some provinces, they do have the anti-conversion law. But the voluntary conversion is not restricted as far as I know. Only the coercion or monetary or physical and any other things, that type of conversion is restricted. But in Nepal, the conversion, any type of, whether it is voluntary or forcefully or monetarily, whatever it is, the conversion from one religion to another religion is strictly prohibited from the very beginning of the promulgation of the law. Even in the constitutions, well, I already told you that we have gone through the 6th constitution. First 3 constitutions does not speak about religions. The constitution is completely silent on the religions issue. Neither is declared a, you know, the theocratic state, nor it is a secular state. It is the silent. Of course, there are some provisions, they say that, of course, the individuals have the right to profess and practice the religions, which they are practiced from ancient time, from generation, I know, which has come to them from generation to generation. Simply that says. Only the constitutions of 1962, it declares Nepal as a Hindu kingdom. It is the first time. It is historically. Before that, of course, everything was, of course, I already told you that the Nepalese society is predominantly the Hindi society. Hindu religious scripts, manuscripts, whatever the way, it has a tremendous impact on the society. But the legally and constitutionally, only in the 1963, Nepal was declared a Hindu kingdom. But the other legal provisions remains intact. Nothing has been changed. That means that it declares a Hindu kingdom, and it said that the king should be the adherent of either Aryan culture and the follower of the Hindu religions. So these are the two things which is binding to be the His Majesty the King. And that provision was remain up to the Constitution 1990. And after the drastic political change in the country, the new interim constitution was promulgated in the 2007, just 2 years ago. It declares Nepal as a republican state. Monarchical system was abolished. And the Nepal was declared an independent, indivisible, sovereign, secular state. Only the constitution declared itself as a secular state. But whereas the other provisions is concerned, it's remainly intact and nothing has been changed. The other provisions of the constitution, which includes right to the religions, Article 23.1 of the constitution, it's clearly said that every person in Nepal has right to practice and profess the religions which come to him from ancient time or from generation to generation. And there is in the prohibitory proviso which explicitly said that the conversion from one religion to another religion is strictly prohibited. So the law and the constitution is Nepal is guarantee only right to profess and practice the religion which come to him from ancient time and from generation to generation. It completely prohibits the right to choose the religions of his or her choice. So this is the constitutional provisions which still remains. Though the Nepal was declared as a secular state, the understanding of secularism or secular state is always a very vague issue. Which modality of secularism is going to adapt Nepal? It is a big question. It is the big question before the constitutional drafters or maker or the constitutional assembly members. So now in the process that these people has to decide which modality of secularism you're going to accept. For some people, the philosophy of secularism is an anti-religious and anti-God philosophy. For some people, the philosophy of secularism is to create to separate state from the religions, and the state has nothing to do with the religion. And some people, the philosophy of secularism is the state should remain impartial, neutral to all religions, and to protect and promote and support the all religions equally without any discrimination at all. So basically, these are the, broadly speaking, these are the things about the understanding of the secularism. But the Nepal is going to adopt the which kind of secularism, whether it is a Marxist secularism, which permits the anti-religious propaganda and prohibits the religious propaganda, either this type of secularism, or the secularism which separates the state from the religion. The state is not going to help or even giving to the any taxpayer money to the any religious institutions or religious society, that type of secularism, or the secularism which support the all the religion equally, which type of secularism going to accept in Nepal. Till today, that question is open. But all the indication, it shows that though constitutionally Nepal is declared as a secular state now, but the constitution does not create a wall between the state and the religion. The constitution, the Nepalese concept of secularism is not the anti-God and anti-religious. So the only remaining thing is remain that the state should treat all the religious equally without any prejudice to the any particular religious and religious community. Not only to support the religious activity, and that thing is doing in the government in the different forms. For example, Muslims are going to Makkah, Medina. Government is subsidizing them to go there for traveling expense and other things. There are so many Hindu rituals and festivals. Government is giving certain money to organize these functions and other things. So government has to give to the other institution also to the equally support or subsidization in form of different government can do all these things. This is one aspect. Another, as a lawyer, there is another big question in the Nepalese society is that whether the freedom to religion includes only to right to profess and practice the religion, or it includes right to choose the religions of his and her choice. That is also another very important question. Nepal, beside this, constitutional provisions and different legislative provisions, Nepal is a party to the many, signatory to the many international instruments, such as Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, International Covenant on Political and Social and Political Rights in 1966, and so on. Especially, the Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights clearly said that the every person has a right to profess and practice the religions of his and her choice. That includes the right to choose the religion of his and her choice. We all know that Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights clearly said that the right to practice and profess the religions, that includes the right to choose the religions of his and her choice. But in Nepal, the constitutionally and the statutory, it is guaranteed only to profess and the practice the right, not the right to choose the religions of his and her choice. And another thing, if the Nepal is a signatory to this international instrument, and the national law, constitution, and other statutory provision is contradict, then what will happen? For this, we have to look upon the Treaty Act of Nepal. Treaty Act of Nepal, 1991, it is clearly says that if the country is a signatory to the international instrument, in that case, the international instrument explicitly gets the supremacy over the national law. Treaty Act is said. So now the Treaty Act is there, international covenant is there, instrument is there where Nepal is a signatory, and the national law is there. With this triangle, what is the problem? The only simple way is the problem, the court has to go to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court has to interpret and say that, well, this is okay. There are several other issues. So these are the questions that are still open. But what is the way to get out all these things? I'm not going to say. I've already told you that just I am going to put you to the exact position of the Nepal. And this is one thing. And another thing, of course, we are in the constitution making process. This is my personal opinion also. I say that, of course, the Nepalese secularism, of course, in Nepal, it is declared as a secularism. Secular state just 2 years ago. The Nepalese secularism should not be anti-religious, anti-God, anti-religious institutions, or the complete separation of state from the religions also. Because the Nepalese social structure is still guided by the old values, norms, cultures, and traditions of Hindu religious and rituals. That one hand side. On the other side, it has become a way of life not only for the followers of Hindus, followers of the other religions also. I told you that there are sometimes the Buddhism, Hinduism is very difficult to distinguish. Maybe some other religions, maybe not to that level, but even then it has so much mix up. So it is very difficult. So the country, though it is a secularized state, it should not be an anti-religious state. It should give the equal treatment to the all religion institutions. Religions, whatever their societies or institutions or whatever they do have, the state should that and do that without any prejudice and any other things. So this is the exact position of about the law and the religions in Nepal. I think I make my presentation within the given time framework. I will be very happy if you have any questions or queries. I am very happy to respond to all your questions and queries. Thank you very much.
It's impressive just the variety that exists within what we tend to think of as one region of the world, and the variety of issues, the variety of histories, cultures, backgrounds, and problems. Please join me in thanking all of our panelists, and then we will pause for about 10 minutes of questions. But before we do that, let's give them a round of applause. We should have a student with a microphone who's going to help us with the questions. Is someone here who's been assigned to that task? Well, here we have someone who's stepping forward as an unassigned volunteer. Thank you. We need you to ask your questions into the microphone, and then we need to give time for the simultaneous interpreters to repeat those questions, and the answers will, in some cases, be in languages other than English. So if you have your headsets, we will begin the questions and answers now. Let me open it to the floor for questions. Questions can be addressed to any of our panelists. We won't divide the question time into periods for each of our panelists. Yes, thank you. One, let me just get the microphone to you, and then we'll get your question.
This question is directed primarily to our guest from China. I'd like a little clarification on the status of house churches, because it seems as though in many cases they are hidden, unapproved, but yet you were able to have a conference. And so is this, they're not approved, but the government doesn't mind? Or could you just clarify that a little bit for me? It would be helpful.
Yes.
This is a very good question. Actually, this is a very complicated phenomenon. I will say, government never recognized the house church and never stopped to fight with them. However, never get success. Because of that, it's caused numerous problems all over China. So finally, government realized to fight with the house church, almost impossible to win this war. So now they changed, not today, but several periods, they changed their strategy. First, it was 1970s, 1980s. Wherever there's house church, government just try to crack down. Then government choose a better strategy, which is only attack the most obvious or active one instead of attack everyone. Finally, government adopt a new strategy, which is as long as no foreigners involved, as long as you are worship yourself in somewhere, not in the public place, government just pretending seeing nothing. I don't know what is words to say that. It's just a fact. Dharma knows all the house church, but try to make a sort of a peace. Not peace, it's just a recognition without a name. Or they won't give your paper, but you can organize yourself. This is why when you ask a house church, where is a house church? No name, no place, but everywhere we have. It depends whether you really want to go. If you want to go, you come to Beijing. I will show you. The biggest one, like 800 or 1,000 house church in Beijing, several one like that. In Shanghai, several one like that. So everyone knows that. It's just no name. Or they do have a name, but no banner on the wall. So you know that is a house church. The reason I can have the conference on house church is because everyone knows this is a problem. No one point out this is a problem. So I said, okay, why are we pretending to see nothing? We need to deal with this issue. If this is a fact, you cannot pretend to see nothing forever. We must find a solution. So Graham agrees that, so we invite the house church, invite the scholar, try to sit down to talk. Why is this problem? What is the solution?
Thank you. Other questions? Wait for the microphone, otherwise the interpreters won't be able to hear you.
Let me follow up with Professor Liu Peng. And you mentioned that the government tried to suppress house churches, but realized it was unsuccessful, so it has backed off. But in another case, Falun Gong, the government decided to suppress them, and they were very successful. So it seems that the government is making some choice of priorities. Falun Gong maybe is more threatening, so they're more vigorous in their suppression. House churches are less threatening, so they're less vigorous. But we know the government has the capacity to absolutely suppress this if they want. So they must make a choice not to do it.
Yes, the bigger concern behind that is if government wants to do that, government could, but it's an issue. How much price government want to pay, which determined by the numbers. If we only have, let's say, 50,000 house church, government can kill all of them or send them to prison, finished. So if we have 5 million or 50 million, how many prison you have to build up? That's the one issue. Second, Falun Gong doesn't have a real background or connection or recognition from the international world or with connection with other countries. It's only China or outside of China, but by Chinese. But Christianity or house church is something always an issue between China and the US. Mr. Gong knows this very well. Each president of US with the China never missed opportunity to raise up issue, religion freedom or something like that. So if China wants to keep a good relation with US, we have a lots of good reason to have a good relation with US. How can we really make things like that to crack down the house church? To anti or to crack down Christian or Christianity is almost impossible in the whole world. How could China get success? But the Falun Gong is not considered as a religion. The doctrine or theology of Falun Gong is very, very little. It's a mixture from Buddhism and Taoism, a little bit about themselves. I will say, mainly is an organization for your body to exercise, to healthy your body. It was good for 10 years, from 1991 to 1999. Then they did some things surrounded Zhongnanhai, the headquarters of CCP, a scared party find, oh, they are very organized with a network, so crack down them. The number of Falun Gong compared with a house church or Christianity is very small. Although they claim they are big, but not very many. So Communist Party is very practical. It's doable. It's realistic to crack down Falun Gong. It's not realistic to crack down Christianity. By the way, Christian has a legal status. We have an official church, a Three Self Church. So it's really hard to say all the Christian is bad. Government purpose is try to put all the house church into official church. But if you don't want to join them, that's not an issue whether you are enemy or not. It's whether you are legal or illegal.
I think we have time for one final question, and then we will close this session. Professor Durham.
This will be just a hopefully short questions to our Japanese and Nepali participants. On Japan, I thought the reference to the religious corporation was very interesting. Most Americans probably don't realize this has emerged in the last decade or so as a predominant form of organization of American religious corporations. And I wonder, you referred to the post-World War II connections, but if there are any connections between current U.S. religious corporation law. And then for Professor Tapa, you describe very carefully sort of the current status on law of conversion. Do you see any possibility in coming years of shifting to a more open ICCPR Article 18 toward approach on right to change religion?
Let's begin with Professor Tajika.
Because my transcript is finished, so I'd like to answer in Japanese. Do you have headset?
Concerning the question posed, it's about the Japanese Religious Cooperation Act and the U.S. Religious Cooperation, if there are any related, or has it had any effect in creating Japanese the Religious Cooperation Act? Concerning the matter, I believe there was a huge effect from the U.S. The operation, cooperation, religious cooperation, after the World War II, Japan was occupied by the United Nations forces, and the GHQ was the headquarters of that force, and their occupied policy was to enforce the advancement of a religious freedom. And so that religious cooperation law that was created at that time was reviewed by a number of law officials or lawmakers within the GHQ. There were a number of lawyers in the GHQ headquarters. Acts were principles were incorporated in the current the Religious Cooperation Act of Japan also.
Okay, regarding the Doram's questions, I think the future also, I think the real chances of lifting this anti, you know, the conversion provision in the Constitution and in the law, because in the parliament, in the constitution assembly also, in other civil society also, highly we hear the any, you know, the pressure demands to lift that provision, that in one. Even rather than there are the some, you know, the fanatics groups, Hindu fanatics groups, and come, you know, Nepal should, you know, the population, 18 million population, or the 80%, more than 80% population of Hindu, it should be remain the Hindu state. That type of, you know, the voice is coming, whereas the lifting the anti-conversion provision, maybe there are some very, you know, as we say, the macroscopic minority, maybe somewhere this type of voice. So regarding the, you know, the Article 18CC also, I see the very rare chances of these things to coming in the near future also. This is my only personal view. Thank you very much.
All right. Once again, please join me in thanking our panelists for a very interesting session.